potentate and privatizer-in-chief, go to the American Postal Workers Union at usmailnotforsale.org.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. You're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
This is Radioactive Magazine, a KKFI public affairs program of progressive activism, opinion, and commentary. Opinions expressed on this program are those of the speakers alone and are not necessarily the views of KKFI, its staff, volunteers, board of directors, show hosts, or other guests on the program.
Welcome to another edition of Radioactive Magazine on KKFI 90.1 FM, Kansas City Community Radio, with your host, Dave Mitchell. Today we are visiting again with Mary Sowantz, a Kansas City environmental activist who we initially spoke with on March 31st. Due to some technical difficulties, our interview was shortened, and we decided to have Mary back for further discussion on her news on our planetary peril. In addition to being an environmental activist, Mary is a writer, poet, artist, and speaker. She taught English for 10 years, has been a stay-at-home mom, a program director for GreenWorks of Kansas City, a farm-to-school coordinator for De La Salle High School, founded her online blog Tonic Wild in 2011, and One Less Pipeline in 2016. Mary has some very insightful observations on our difficulties in responding adequately to the existential perils inherent in human-induced global warming and the mass extinction of species. Mary, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
Okay. Just a note to our viewers, if we do get cut off, if Mary and I do get cut off, we'll call Mary on a smartphone here and reconnect, so just have patience. Mary, in our prior conversation, you strongly recommended the book Braiding Sweetgrass by Robin Wall Kimmerer, who was a botanist, writer, professor of plant ecology, and a Potawatomi woman. An online library summary indicates her central argument is that an awakening of a wider ecological consciousness requires the acknowledgement and celebration of our reciprocal relationship with the world. And as a Potawatomi woman, she learned to consider plants and animals to be our oldest teachers. What are a few themes from Braiding Sweetgrass that have most influenced your thinking?
So I came to this book, I think, this year. So I just started reading it, I think, in the wintertime. And there's just so many things to love about it. I think one of the things that is most striking about how she braids her indigenous knowledge and wisdom with her scientific wisdom is just this incredible intimacy and reverence. And it's very rooted, her experiences and what she's describing is very rooted in place. So there's nothing abstract or disconnected from what she's talking about when she talks about her relationship with the living world. I also just, the idea that plants and animals are elders to be respected, again, to me that implies that we have sort of a humility about us, ourselves, our place within ecosystems and in relationship to other living beings. And so that idea, again, to me kind of goes with that sense of place. Not only will we know our place, but that idea of where we are in the hierarchy of beings metaphorically, but we also know it in a very visceral way, in a very contextual, concrete way. And so those are a couple of things that really struck me. There's this also, within that paradigm is this idea of bounty, and that the living world is based on abundance, versus the capitalist mindset, which is all about scarcity, right? So there's something beautiful about this idea of bounty. And again, that's rooted to place. Wherever you are in the natural world, there is enough. It is our job to figure out how to live and align ourselves and our needs with that bounty and not try to lord ourselves over it, if that makes sense. So those are some of the themes that really resonated with me.
Yeah, those things definitely resonate very strongly with me too. I think the the whole idea, I don't particularly like the word sustainability, but the whole idea of coming into our harmonious relationship with the natural world is to find a way to interact with it and in a way that's beneficial. And and that's a whole lot easier said than done, given how many people we have and the kind of society we have. Is there anything, I think, Robin Wall Kimmerer, she's a PhD botanist, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And she's a scientist, and she comes from, I really like that idea of having a reciprocal relationship with a sense that there's a connection between us and the natural world, us and plants and animals.
Right. And what I like about that reciprocity, according to how she's defining it, is that we are not the masters here. We are being guided by the natural world in terms of how we reciprocate and what our right and appropriate role is in that reciprocal relationship, rather than we are determining that. So when I think about that as a gardener, I'm thinking about how I've been conditioned to designate some things as edible and some things as weeds, rather than understanding that what's growing here and in my garden is of value, not only the thing that I planted. And so the old thinking was that if I'm weeding, I'm creating space for the things, my agenda, for the things that I want to grow. And of course, as someone who grows food, that's kind of the way we do things, rather than there's so much out there that's already growing that heretofore has been and is edible and medicinal and also serves, in some cases, a spiritual function. Like, it's all already there, but we have created a dualism that says some of it is worthwhile and some of it is not, and it's a false dualism. We can't have that dualism and have an abundant, a mindset of abundance, if that makes sense.
Right. So does she argue in Brady Sweetgrass that the earth is a living being? Does she make that argument or that assertion? Does she talk in that way?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what are your feelings on that? I mean, how do you envision that?
If the earth is
a living being, yeah. Can you say something about that? Beyond that statement,
that just flies in the face of so much of my conditioning as someone who grew up in a Judeo-Christian setting where the earth is something that we act on. It's an it. And that's one of the things that I really, really enjoyed about her book, and that was eye-opening, is that Native American languages, so many of them, they are majority verbs, where the English language is majority nouns with fewer verbs. That means most things are considered its, an it, right? Something to be acted upon rather than they have sovereignty and are animate from within. Mm-hmm. So that's a whole different mindset in terms of approaching the world around us, because language creates the paradigm with which we engage everything else.
Right.
So of course it's a living being, but we have conditioned ourselves to forget that.
yeah, I know, you know, not only the Gaia theory, you know, put forth by James Lovelock in his book, I think The Revenge of Gaia, or it's one of his books. He posits the idea, and the Gaia theory basically is that the Earth acts as a living being, and he comes from an extremely scientific background, and he kind of came to the same conclusion. But in terms of language, I mean, I know that one of the things that you talk about, one of the central ideas that you talk about in your writings is the failure of the environmentalists of the global north not engaging the consumerist expectations pressuring the average American family, many of whom are black and brown. You see the need to identify and pull back the veils of consumerese, that's the word you use, and engage mm-hmm. in a wide education in the ideas and language of environmentalese. And how would you define those ideas?
Well, before I explain how I define it, let me talk a little bit about the background behind that. So okay. I learned a lot about environmentalese from researching environmental issues and from my work with GreenWorks, and I learned a lot from working with Bridging the Gap. So I taught myself a lot, and I learned a lot through the environmental nonprofits that I worked with and volunteered with. So that was happening along one thread. And then the other thread was I became a mom and had children. And when they're very young, it's quite possible to raise them up in an environmental world, like, you know, buying things only from thrift stores, limiting the access to the consumer pressure that's on families. And then they go to school, and then all of a sudden you are thrown into a world where you are expected to engage in this level of consumerism that is antithetical to a habitable planet, just point blank. It just, right. You cannot consume the amount of stuff that they ask you to consume when you have children. And then kids will get into activities, and then all those activities require gear, require uniforms, require you to sell more unsustainable stuff, and then to go on trips and so on and so forth. So there's this trajectory of consumption, and then there's birthday parties. I mean, it goes on and on and on. It's bewildering. Mm. And so I felt like I was on two tracks that never intersected. And when they intersected, it was in this very nominal sort of even performative way, like, oh, look, we're going to use reusable plates at a kid's birthday party. Like, that's minor compared to what is ultimately necessary for all children to have a habitable planet.
Right.
So I felt like I was in it speaking one language, environmentalese, when I was in these environments, and then consumerese when I was engaged in my children's schooling and then their extracurricular activities. And so for me, it was like we are all going to fall in that vast crevice right there between these two things, because these languages are not speaking to each other. And what's interesting is, like, environmentalese has a particular set and formula of what is appropriate environmental behavior. You know, it's the three R's. It's the reusable everything. It's solar panels. It's EVs. It's native plants. It's, you know, all of that stuff. And then the consumeries, or what I feel like is the most dominant culture, is based on a whole bunch of behaviors, and particularly school culture is based on a whole bunch of behaviors that say, well, your goal is to get a job so you can buy a bunch of stuff, right? And so it's like we're conditioning kids to go on a particular trajectory. And sometimes those two cross paths in that, both languages are completely external action driven rather than relationship driven, which I put in contrast as we're talking about, like, I want to bring in Braiding Sweetgrass for a minute. The language that she uses to talk about the planet is a language of relationship. Environmentalese is not a language of relationship. It's a language of, here are the things to do.
Oh, you mean consumerism?
Like,
yeah. Didn't you mean
consumerism? I'm sorry, go ahead.
Didn't you mean consumerism is not
an example, yeah. So you're supposed to recycle. Don't use a plastic straw. Go buy a metal straw. Drive less. Change your light bulbs. Turn off lights. You know, buy used clothes. Like, it's all these behaviors that are context-free. At the same time, consumerese is saying buy this, buy this, buy this, you need this, you need this, you need that. That's also context-free because there's no ecological understanding of where that stuff is being extracted, manufactured. You know, we don't know anything about the story behind the thing that we are actually purchasing. So both of them absolutely disjointed from the living world and from the people in the living world. We don't talk about, like, environmentally, it's about me and my relationship with the planet, and overlooks, especially in the environmental movement of the global north, overlooks the people along the way who are impacted by our environmental choices and our consumer choices. Does that make sense? So there's disconnect in both languages. Neither language is sufficient for engaging the world in a just and sustainable way.
Right.
Neither language is adequate because they're both siloed, and they both are pursuing their own agenda.
Well, they're both. Sounds like they're both siloed, and they both fail to truly address what we need to do. I think is the.
Absolutely.
That's my sense of it. Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely correct. Yeah, I mean, I guess an example that I really harp on is the whole idea of metal straws. Like, we learned that plastic straws were bad because they were harming sea animals, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the alternative isn't to replace one thing that we know that is bad with something else without considering the impact of that something else, right? Like, what's the point of metal straws if we don't know where the metal was extracted, how it was manufactured, what was its environmental footprint to get to us from our, you know, here in the United States? Like, that doesn't make sense. But so that's what happens when we take a piece of one language and, you know, insert it into a way of being. We can't go on with this way. So
right.
I guess that begs the question, so what do we do? And to me, it's like, how do we re-educate or start to educate children from a very young age at school in ecological literacy? So it's a language where we understand our choices on the living planet, on other human beings, on other living beings with whom we share the planet.
Mm-hmm.
So, because, again, when we study science in school, it's very siloed. It's disconnected from the day-to-day impact we have on the planet. So kids learn about the water cycle, but that's disconnected from how they impact the water cycle by their choices.
And I think the idea when you talk about consumerist expectations, I mean, I keep thinking about the fact that there's so much pressure just in terms of the way we live our lives, and that there are just certain accepted things about the way we live our lives, and one would be is that you can fly all over the world for vacation or to see your mom in Seattle this is an accepted way of living, and I think I personally, you know, there's what I'm struck with in the environmental movement is that there are many volunteers that I know that live high carbon lifestyles, and there's a disconnect, you know, there's a disconnect between their supposed commitment to working on whatever the issue is and the fact that they live, that there doesn't seem to be any commitment in their personal lives to living a lower carbon lifestyle. So,
yeah, that's tricky. Part of it is because it's not about relationships. It's still siloed. You know, we're not immersed in sort of a relationship with ourselves in a sense, and also with each other, and also the particular, I always think about this in terms of the particular longitude and latitude that we are in. Like, all work has to start there. Where do I live? What is here? In what do I share this particular place? Who and what do I share this particular place with? What is this space supposed to look like in a natural way? I think of what, when you were saying, I was thinking about when you were talking, I was thinking about lawns and how ubiquitous they are and how they're not a thing. They're not real. It's an illusion because they don't exist in the natural world and they're not habitat for anything. And yet they're everywhere. And that sort of disconnect from what is supposed to be here naturally, that is habitat and offers us abundance, has been removed. I mean, that's another form of disconnect that we don't talk about, you know, enough in my world.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the whole drive of our consumerist culture is there's no question that we are we're engaged in a process of ecocide, essentially, and through global warming and the mass extinction of species. So the entire collective human impact of the way we live our lives that's doing this. And I know you talk, a central idea you talk about is the fact that to really truly, my understanding is from your point of view, is that to truly move forward, we need to sit and dwell with our grief over the damage we're causing, you know, our planet. And I know, can you talk about that a little bit, and why it's necessary to do that?
Well, so I think for me, the grief is about what we're doing to ourselves, what we're doing to each other, what we're doing to other living beings, and what we're doing to the planet. And I guess in that order, like, what we're doing is, how we live is incredibly violent. And yet it's a normalized form of violence. And that's very grievous. I mean, we are disrespecting ourselves and what we were created to be in this world. And I don't mean that like in a Judeo-Christian way. I just mean how I think COVID-19 is just showing how deeply traumatized we are, and how deeply traumatizing our world is in terms of how we are unable to we are unable to take care of those most vulnerable, and we are absolutely callous with those most vulnerable. And who is being most impacted by COVID-19 is the most vulnerable. So that, to me, is sort of like a template, a very real-time template of the sort of grief that is ever present in my mind when I'm thinking about environmental issues, particularly when I put that in contrast with consumerist lifestyles, the things that we choose. And as parents, a lot of times we choose things out of love for our children without understanding that what we're doing out of love for our children endangers and threatens the lives of children elsewhere around the world. And that is grievous. And the wall of ignorance between us and understanding that, the impact we have on others, that is something to reckon with. And that is something that environmentalese doesn't get at. Mm-hmm. You know, that language isn't there to talk about how we are impacting others by our consumerist choices.
Right.
And so to me, that's what I call environmental supremacy, this idea that we can make all these choices here, even as environmentalists, that are completely removed from the lives and suffering of other people and other beings elsewhere.
Boy, this is a lot to unpack. I mean, I know we just have a few minutes left here. You know, I know that, you know, I know in your workshops that you offer to faith communities, you talk mm-hmm. about emphasizing the seeking of healing, emancipation, and the affirmation of community through the spiritual lens of atonement. And, you know, I know, can you talk about the process of atonement a little bit? You know, how we how that dovetails in with our grief.
In 2 minutes. Yeah, in 2 minutes. Yeah, you know, I think
maybe that's not fair of me to ask that.
That's fine. It's a good challenging question because it just helps me fine tune my own thinking, right? So thank you for that. I think so I am on this journey myself. So as all of us, my perception and my understanding is always evolving, right? So one of the things that when I worked for Greenworks and when I was first starting in the environmental trajectory, I was very pious and I had a lot of environmental piety and a lot of judgment towards what is right environmental behavior and what is bad behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, there's this pretty strict line of what's appropriate and what's not appropriate in terms of being an environmentalist. And so there was a lot of judgment there. And I think when you have a checklist and you follow that, it's easy to forget that it is about humans and their needs and their wants and their aspirations. And all of us are constantly juggling those things in the choices that we make and our woundedness, right? Like we make choices out of our wants, our needs, and our woundedness and our aspirations. And all of that we carry with us. So when we sit and talk about what is the right thing to do in terms of the environment, we have to take in all those things into consideration. And so what I want, if people come to my workshops, is to not walk away feeling guilty and overwhelmed and burdened,
right,
but to understand themselves within all those things. Uh-huh. And then also, like, so that's one circle. And then the outer circle is, okay, how does that fit into my community? And then how do we draw those rings out into the world uh-huh. and other living beings and then the living world?
Well, and I think in atonement is the process of being able to forgiveness, you know, forgiveness mm-hmm. of forgiveness of self and forgiveness of others for the way they're living. And Mary, I'm sorry, but we're out of time. I really apologize. But
oh, no, thanks for the conversation.
Well, thank you very much for being on the show and we didn't have any technical glitches this time, which is always good.
So, that was fantastic. Yeah, thank you for the work you do.
Okay.
KKFI is definitely a necessary radio station during these times, especially, but okay. always. So thank you for the work you do.
Okay, all right. Well, thank you for being on the show. I appreciate it.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
And thank you for tuning in to Radioactive Magazine. Tune in next week when our host, Pat Riley, will have another intellectually stimulating discussion about the issues of the day. We have just enough time to say today is Tuesday, Giving Tuesday. This is a nationwide effort to encourage support for those in need. As we know, during this time, there are just really lots and lots of needs out there, and there's a lot of nonprofits that are doing a lot of good work to help those in need. There are arts organizations that are really hurting now, that if you can find a way to support them, we're asking you to give some consideration to that. But KKFI is also one of those nonprofit organizations, and if you would choose to support us during Giving Tuesday, we would appreciate that. If you want to, but we do want to encourage you to at least participate in Giving Tuesday. If you're one of those that was lucky enough to maybe get some stimulus money, but you didn't really need it, maybe you could use that to share with some of your community organizations. If you would like to support KKFI, which obviously we are one of those that also are having our own financial issues during this season. So if you do want to support KKFI, you can go to kkfi.org or giving us a call at 888-931-0901. Again, thank you for tuning in to Radioactive Magazine. And as always, keep your dials tuned right here for Counterspin.